Old man. What do you know of my grief? You're a stripling lad who's never had a woman.
Youth.
And you're a whining old bastard. It's the likes of you cost me all the hope of me life. You think I can't know the grief of something taken because I'd not yet had it?
From Plague Time, an Irish play. On the flight to Paris, John reflected carefully on the things he had done and was doing to cover his tracks. The plane was a Boeing 727 with one of the facelifts the airline was promoting. Slick leather upholstery in first class, extra cabin attendants there, a fine choice of wines and food. John's seatmate was a chunky Israeli businessman who bragged that he had ordered kosher. John made no response, merely looked out the window beside him at the cloud cover over the Atlantic. The businessman shrugged and brought out a briefcase, from which he took sheafs of paper, on which he set to work. John glanced at his wristwatch, calculating the time difference to Seattle. By now, investigators would be raking through the ashes of the Ballard House. They would suspect arson immediately, of course. An all-consuming blaze. Multiple thermite charges, phosphor arranged to spill from its water cover, exploding bottles of ether ammonium hydroxide. The investigators naturally would seek human remains, but not even bones could survive the heat of that fire. It would not be surprising to have them conclude that John McCarthy, the inventor, had perished in the accidental ignition of one of his experiments. The high heat could be enough. And the investigators would be scrambling the evidence they would want later. By then, it would be too late. The ashes hopelessly disturbed. John's wrist itched under the watch. He removed the watch and scratched, glancing at the back of the case. The engraving was professionally scrolled there, a Spencerian J.G.O.D. John Garrett O'Day, or John Garrick O'Donnell. The O'Day passport nestled in his coat pocket next to his heart. The O'Donnell passport lay with the spares in the secret compartment of the carry-on bag under the seat in front of him. He restored the watch to his wrist. The engraving was a small touch, but he thought a good one. His wallet contained the proper confirmations for the O'Day identity. The Social Security card had been the easiest forgery of them all. Before becoming a chunk of melted slag in the Ballard basement, the little letterpress had produced an assortment of calling cards and letterheads. His checkbook was a valid one from Seattle First National Bank, the home address, one of his drops. Not much money there, but enough to establish the account's validity. The bag next to his feet contained letters from invented friends and business associates, all addressed to the proper drop, stamps cancelled. Everything agreed with his passport. John Garrett O'Day would stand up under any casual investigation, not that he expected such an occurrence. With the spare passports in the bag at his feet was his forger's kit and $238,000 in United States currency. He had $20,000 in traveler's checks, purchased in $5,000 blocks, in a leather pouch around his waist. His wallet held $2,016 U.S. and 2,100 French francs, neat and crisp bills from the Dique Pereira counter at SeaTac Airport. He thought of this money as the ready energy to complete O'Neill's revenge. At Charles de Gaulle Airport, he rode up through the rather dated plastic tubes to baggage claim, retrieved his other bag, and strode out under the nothing-to-declare sign into a dark afternoon. The smell of diesel was thick under the concrete canopy covering the taxi and bus pickup lanes. The sounds of engines were loud and jangling. A darkly Romanesque woman with heavy features and thick lips stood directly ahead of him in the taxi queue, surrounded by shopping bags and tattered luggage, shouting in harsh Italian at two teenage girls who apparently did not want to wait there. Her voice grated on John. His head felt clogged, thinking slowed. He ascribed this to the swift change of time zones. His circadian rhythms were wrong. He felt a positive relief when the Italian woman and her children climbed into a taxi and drove off. It was even better to enter his own taxi and lean back against the cool upholstery. The car was a shiny blue Mercedes diesel, the driver a thin, sharp-featured man wearing a black nylon jacket with a rip at the right shoulder from which white lining material protruded. "Hotel Normandy," John said, and closed his eyes. There was a pain in his stomach, and he thought, "I'm hungry." The hotel would have room service, and a bed. Sleep. That was what he needed. He did not actually sleep in the taxi, although he kept his eyes closed most of the way. There was a general awareness behind his eyes of the swift movement along the autoroute. The occasional sound of a heavy truck intruded on his dozing. The driver uttered several low-voiced curses. Once there was the screech of a high-pitched horn. He was aware when they pulled off the périphérique onto the streets of Paris, the change of rhythm, more stops and starts. It was almost dark when they reached the hotel, and it was beginning to rain, a light drizzle. He paid off the driver and added a generous tip, which elicited a growled, "Merci, monsieur." There was no bellman. John picked up his bags and shouldered his way through the two swinging glass doors, to be met there by a hurrying older man in a red-piped beige uniform, who took the bags and greeted him in English. "Welcome, sir. Welcome." The lobby smelled of a pungent insecticide. When he was in his room, a change of clothing laid out for morning, John put a hand on his stomach. Tender. And it felt hard and distended. "I don't have time to be sick." The room was oppressive, too warm, and it smelled musty. He closed the shades on the two tall windows, which looked onto the Avenue Saint-Honoré, turned to survey his quarters. A drab green and gray floral pattern in the wallpaper. He could hear the old-fashioned elevator grinding and clanking nearby. The room was not even square. It was a trapezoid with a double bed in the wide end. The door to a tiny bathroom opened off one corner of the narrow end, an entry achieved by skirting a heavy bureau. For a closet there was a giant monstrosity of dark wood furniture beside the bed, drawers in the center, hanging space on each side behind creaking doors. The bottom drawer came out to reveal a thin space underneath. He put his wallet, passport, and traveler's checks there, and returned the drawer to its proper place. "I'll call room service for some soup." He felt his gorge rising at this thought and barely made it to the bathroom, where he vomited into the toilet. He slipped to his knees beside the toilet, one hand clutching the washbasin, his stomach heaving and heaving. Damn. 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 In the back of his mind lay the fear that he had picked up a stray from his lab, a random offshoot of his perfectly tailored plague, something unnoticed in the rush of success. Presently he climbed to his feet, bathed his face in the washbasin, and flushed the toilet. His legs trembled with weakness. He staggered out of the bathroom and threw himself face down on the bedspread. It smelled of caustic soap, and his nose was surrounded by the stink of vomit. Should I call a doctor? The American hospital would have a reliable doctor. But a doctor would be the most likely to remember him. And a doctor would prescribe antibiotics. John reflected on the fact that he had made his plague to feed on antibiotics. What if it is a stray from the lab? On willpower alone, he climbed to his feet, put his precious carry-on bag on the floor of the clothes cupboard, and closed the creaking door. He leaned against the cool wood for a moment to recover his strength. Pushing himself away from the cupboard, he fell back onto the bed and weakly pulled part of the bedspread over him. There was a switch beside the head of the bed. He reached it on the third try. Welcome darkness engulfed the room. "Not now," he whispered. "Not yet." He was not aware of falling asleep, but there was daylight around the edges of the window draperies when next he opened his eyes. He tried to sit up, and his muscles would not obey. A surge of panic swept over him. His body was cold and drenched in perspiration. Slowly, by a concentrated focusing of his will, he got one hand out, groped for and found the telephone. The operator, thinking he wanted housekeeping, sent a Spanish maid, a buxom elderly woman with dyed gray hair and thick arms, the muscles compressed by tight sleeves. Using her own key, she swept into the room, wrinkled her nose at the thick smell of vomit, took in John's face, pale and weak above the rumpled bedspread, and said in thickly accented English,
"You wish a doctor, senor?"
Gasping between each word, John managed,
"They aren't too expensive."
"Everything is expensive," she agreed, coming to stand beside his head. She put a cool palm on his forehead.
"You have the fever, senor. It is the terrible French sauces. They are bad for the stomach. You should stay away from the rich foods. I will bring you something. We see how you are in a little while, eh?"
She patted his shoulder.
"And I am not as expensive as the doctors."
He did not sense her departure, but presently she was there beside him again with a steaming cup of something hot in her hand. He smelled chicken soup.
"A little broth for the stomach," she said, helping him to sit up.
The broth burned his tongue but felt soothing in his stomach. He drank most of it before sinking back against the pillows, which the Spanish maid fluffed for him.
"I am Consuela," she said. "I will come back when I have finished the other rooms. You are better then, eh? We get you into bed proper."
Consuela returned with more broth, awakening him and helping him to swing his feet off the bed. She had to steady him there.
"You drink," she said.
She held his hand with the cup, forcing him to drink all of the broth.
"You are better," she said,
but he did not feel better.
"What time is it?"
he asked.
"It is time to make the bed and get you into clothing of the night," she said.
She brought a chair from outside, wedged it beside the head of the bed, and lifted him into the chair, where he sat while she straightened the bed and folded back the covers.
"God, she's strong," he thought. "You are a modest man," she said,
standing in front of him, the thick arms akimbo, hands on hips.
"We remove only to the underclothing, eh?"
She chuckled.
"Do not have the face red, senor. I have buried two husbands."
She crossed herself. Unable to resist, barely able to comment, John went passive while Consuela undressed him and muscled him into the bed. The sheets felt cool against his flesh. She left the draperies closed, but he still could see daylight around them.
"What time is it?"
he managed.
"It is time for Consuela to do much other work. I come back with more broth. You gotta hungry?"
"No." He shook his head weakly. A wide grin illuminated her face.
"You are lucky man for Consuela, eh? I speak the good English, no?"
He managed a nod.
"It is lucky thing. In Madrid I am the maid for Americans. My first husband is Mexican from Chicago in the USA. He is teach me."
"Thank," was all he could say. "Gracias, adios," she said, and let herself out of the room. John slept. His sleep was tormented by dreams of Mary and the twins.
"Please, no more O'Neill dreams," he muttered.
He turned and twisted in the bed, unable to escape the O'Neill memories. The twins playing in the backyard of their home, Mary laughing with joy at a Christmas present.
"She was so happy,"
he whispered.
"Who was the happy?"
It was Consuela standing beside him. Darkness framed the draperies of the windows. He smelled the chicken broth. A muscular arm slipped behind him and levered him upright. The other hand held the broth for him to drink. It was only lukewarm, and it tasted even better than the first time. He heard the clunk of the cup as she placed it on the stand beside the telephone.
"Excusado,"
she said, and snapped her fingers.
"Bathroom. You wish to go to the bathroom?"
He nodded. She half carried him into the bathroom and left him leaning against the washbasin.
"I wait outside," she said. "You call, eh?"
When she had him back in the freshly made bed, he asked,
"What day This day? It is the day after you arrive, Señor O'Day. It is the day O'Day is better, eh?
She grinned at her own joke. All he could give her was a twitching of the lips.
You do not wish the expensive doctor, Señor?
He shook his head from side to side.
We see tomorrow, she said.
She let herself out, pausing to give him a cheery hasta mañana before closing the door. Morning was identifiable by the return of Consuela. This time she brought a small bowl with a coddled egg in addition to the broth. She propped him up with pillows and spooned the egg into his mouth, wiping his chin as though he were a baby before giving him the broth. John thought he felt stronger, but his brain remained fuzzy, and there was this maddening inability to identify the day or the hour. Consuela frustrated him by responding to his question with quips.
It is the day O'Day eats two eggs in the morning. It is the day O'Day has the bread and meat for dinner. It is the day O'Day has ice cream with his comida. Day O'Day. Day O'Day.
Consuela's cheerful face became an uncountable daily blur, but John could feel his strength returning. One day he took a bath. He no longer needed help getting to the bathroom. When Consuela took his breakfast dishes away, he lifted the telephone and asked for the manager. The operator said she would connect him immediately with Monsieur Desplay. And Desplay was on the line in almost 2 minutes, speaking with a pronounced British accent.
"Ah, Mr. O'Day, I have been meaning to call you about your bill. We usually require weekly payment, and it has been 9 days. But in the circumstances..."
He cleared his throat.
"If you will send someone, I will sign the necessary traveler's checks," John said. "Right away, sir. I'll bring the bill myself."
John retrieved a packet of traveler's checks from beneath the cupboard drawer and was waiting in bed with them when Desplay arrived.
"Gerard Desplay at your service, sir."
The manager was a tall, gray-haired man with pleasant, even features and a wide mouth with large teeth. He presented the bill on a small black tray, a pen placed neatly at one side. John signed 10 checks and asked that the surplus be brought to him.
"For Consuela," he explained. "A jewel among jewels," Desplay said. "Myself, I would have consulted a doctor, but all's well that ends well. I must say you're looking much fitter, sir." "Then you looked in on me?" John asked. "In the circumstances, sir."
Desplay picked up the tray and the signed checks.
"But Consuela is often correct about the illnesses of guests. She has been with us for a long time. If I had my own establishment in France, I would steal her away from you," John said.
Desplay chuckled.
"A constant hazard in our business, sir. Is it permitted to inquire of your business in Paris?" "I'm an investment consultant," John lied.
He favored Desplay with a speculative look.
"And I'm overdue on an important project. I'm wondering if the hotel could get me a hire car with an English-speaking driver."
"For what day, sir?" John consulted his inner reserves, still very weak.
"But in only 4 days. Achill Island. The letters."
There were things to be done before he dared take his next step. He could feel time pressing on him. Plans would have to be changed. He took a deep, trembling breath.
"Tomorrow? Is that wise, Mr. O'Day? You do look much better, thanks to Consuela's excellent care, but even so..."
"It's necessary," John said. Desplay lifted his shoulders in a pronounced shrug.
"Then may I ask as to your destination, sir?"
"Luxembourg. And then perhaps back to Orly. I'm not sure. I'll need the car for several days."
"By car?"
Desplay was visibly impressed. "Then,
Orly? You would fly to some destination?"
"I had thought when I was a bit stronger."
"There is talk of another strike by the air traffic controllers," Desplay said. "Then I may have the car take me to England."
"So far?" Desplay's tone said he thought his guest profligate. as did the rest of the hotel's staff, especially Consuela.
These Americans, he will not pay the doctor. Too costly. But he hires a car and English-speaking driver for such a journey. My Americans in Madrid displayed the same species of madness. They scream about pesetas, and then buy the television so big it cannot be moved except by the technician.
I think men have always been mostly a dense and unfeeling lot, their emotions covered with scar tissue. They resist the sensitivity and fulfillment that comes from women, the cement that holds everything together. When our keepers leave the speaker switch open, I hear Porrick out there mumbling about which man he'll take into his friendship circle, worrying over the names, now this one and now that. Friendship circle. They're all looking for something that'll put us back together, something to hold them and carry them through these terrible times.
The Diary of Kate O'Gara Browder. Beckett lay stretched out, fully clothed, on the Spartan cot in his tiny quarters at the DIC. His hands were behind his head, and he could feel the lumpy pillow on his knuckles. The only light in the room came from the illuminated clock on the desk near his head. 2:33 a.m. He kept his eyes open, staring upward into the darkness. When he swallowed, it was past a lump in his throat.
Thank God my family's still safe, he thought.
That entire area of northern Michigan had been cordoned off by special troops.
We're going the way of France and Switzerland. Fragmented.
If he closed his eyes, he knew his mind would be filled with memory pictures of Arianna Foss as she lay dying.
I'm freezing, she'd kept complaining.
Between the complaints, however, she had provided them with a clinical picture of her symptoms as seen from within by a mind finely tuned to medical details. The room in the hospital facility had light green walls, a hard plastic floor scored by the frequent applications of antiseptic. There were no windows, only an inset picture of peaks in the Cascades, a thing mostly of greens and blues, designed to give the illusion of space beyond this sterile room. Lines of gray-clad wire ran from beneath Foss's bedding, out over the head of her bed and into a console that linked them to the ivory box of the electronic system that monitored her vital signs. Only one transparent plastic tube ran down from an IV bottle into her right arm. Sterile fluid. From his chair close beside her bed, Beckett could keep an eye on the monitor and on the patient. Her lips moved. No sound. Eyes closed. Lips moved again, then...
There was that odd sort of disorientation at the onset,
she whispered.
You got that?
I got it, Ari.
With Dorina, too? What does she say?
Beckett moved a swing arm lamp closer over the notebook in his lap, made a note. We'll have a report from Joe presently, he said.
Presently?
She whispered.
What's that mean?
In an hour or so.
I may not be here in an hour or so. This thing's fast, Bill. I can feel it.
I want you to think back, Beckett said. What's the first thing you experienced that you suspect may have been a symptom?
There was a white spot on the instep of my right foot this morning, she said.
White spots on extremities, Beckett wrote. Nothing earlier? He asked. She opened her eyes. They looked glazed and the eyelids were swollen. Her skin had the pale, bloodless look of death, almost the color of the pillow beneath her head. Her baby doll features were bloated, the curly hair tangled and sweaty.
Think back, he said.
She closed her eyes, then...
No.
What? He bent close to her mouth.
It couldn't have been,
she whispered. What?
Day before yesterday. I woke up horny as hell.
He leaned back and scribbled in his notebook.
You writing that down too?
She whispered. Anything at all could be important. What else?
I took a bath and... Jesus! my gut aches.
He made a note, then, you took a bath.
It was odd. The water never seemed hot enough. I thought it was the damn conservationists, but there was lots of steam, and my skin turned red. Felt cold, though.
Sensory distortion, he wrote. Then, did you run any cold water over yourself?
No.
She moved her head slowly from side to side.
And I was hungry. God, I was hungry. I ate two breakfasts. I thought it was just all this upset and, you know.
Did you check your pulse?
I don't think so. I don't remember. God, it bothered me eating that much. I'm always worried about gaining weight. Where have you got Dorina?
Just down the hall. We've rigged a UV gauntlet and antiseptic sprays in a passage between the two rooms. We thought it was a good idea, just in case.
In case one of us makes it and the other doesn't. Good thinking. I don't think I'm going to make it, Bill. What's that stuff in the IV?
Just fluid. We're going to try some new blood in a few minutes. You need white cell stimulation.
So it hits the marrow.
We're not sure.
When I saw that spot on my instep, Bill, I think I knew right then. My guts felt like a block of ice. I didn't want to think about it. You noticed the spot on Dorena's hand?
Yes.
Do a good autopsy,
she said.
Find out everything you can.
She closed her eyes, then snapped them open.
Was I unconscious very long?
Just now?
No. When you brought me in here.
About an hour.
It hit like a ton of bricks, she said. I remember you sitting me on the edge of the bed to help me into the gown. Then, whap!
Your blood pressure went way down, he said.
I thought so. What about the other women in the DIC? Is it spreading?
I'm afraid so.
Shit.
She was silent for a moment, then...
Bill, I don't think your antiseptic gauntlet will be much use. I think men are the carriers.
I'm afraid you're right. He cleared his throat.
How much fever?
She asked. First high, and now it's slow grade. 99.7. He looked up at the monitor. Heartbeats 140.
You going to try digitalis?
I've ordered some linoxin, but we're still debating it. It didn't do much for Dorena.
The autopsy,
she whispered.
Look. For fibroblasts.
He nodded.
Got a hunch,
she said.
Liver feels like a used football.
Beckett made a note.
You try interferon, Dorena?
She whispered. Yes.
Well?
Might as well have been water.
Noticed my nurse was male,
she said.
How bad is it with the other women?
Bad.
What are you doing?
We closed the isolation doors. We're lucky this whole damn complex was designed to resist the spread of radioactive contamination.
Think any of them will make it?
Too early to tell.
Any idea how it got in here?
Any of us could have brought it in. Lepikov thinks it was him. He says he can't make any contact with his home in the Soviet Union.
Danza is from Brittany,
she whispered. But he hasn't been there for a long time.
Lepikov,
she said.
He got all kinds of briefings before being sent over here. Godolinsky complained about it. Specialists, envoys.
Lepikov believes he had a low-grade infection.
You have any symptoms?
She asked. A small case of the sniffles and a slight fever, but that was 5 days ago.
5 days, she whispered. And already I'm dying.
We think the incubation period may be as little as 3 or 4 days, he said. Perhaps even shorter. It may take a couple of days for a man to become an active carrier.
Benign in men, fatal in women, she whispered.
Then stronger,
that madman is one sick son of a bitch. They still think it's O'Neill?
Nobody doubts it anymore.
You think he's a carrier, too?
Beckett shrugged. No sense telling her about Seattle and Tacoma. She had enough on her plate. I'd like to cover your symptoms one more time.
One more time may be all we have.
Don't give up, Ari.
Easy for you to say.
She fell silent for almost a minute, then...
Loose bowels that morning, I felt so horny. Then thirst. Do Raina have that too?
Identical, he said.
The headache. Jesus, it was bad for a time. Not so bad now. You giving me any painkiller in that IV?
Not yet.
My nipples ache, she said. Did I tell you to do the best damn autopsy of your life?
You told me. Danza tiptoed in and whispered to Beckett,
Dorena just died.
I heard that,
Foss said.
That's another thing, Bill. Acute hearing. Everything's so goddamn loud. Can you get me a rabbi?
We're trying, Danza said.
A fine time for me to go back to... Damn! My fucking stomach's on fire!
She stared past Beckett at Danza.
That madman's a dirty sadist. He must know how much agony he's causing.
Beckett considered telling her what they had discovered, that most women lapsed into a coma and died without waking. He decided against it. No sense revealing that the efforts to keep Ariana alive were prolonging her pain.
O'Neill,
she whispered.
I wonder if his wife felt any...
She closed her eyes and fell silent. Beckett put a hand to the artery in her neck. He nodded toward the monitor above her bed. Blood pressure 60/30. Pulse dropping.
Every antibiotic we tried on Dorena only worsened her condition, Danza said. But perhaps we could try some chemo...
No!
It was Foss, her voice surprisingly loud and shrill.
We agreed. Shotgun for Dorena. Nothing for me.
She turned a glazed stare toward Beckett.
Don't tell my husband about the pain.
Beckett swallowed past a lump.
I won't.
Tell him it was easy. Very quiet.
Would you like some morphine? Beckett asked.
I can't think with morphine. If I can't think, I can't tell you what's happening to me.
A male nurse in army blues with a white jacket entered the room. He was a young man with flat, pinched features. His name tag read Diggins. He stared fearfully at Foss's still figure. Beckett looked up at him. You find a proper blood type with a low-grade infection?
Yes, sir.
He's a confirmed bladder infection. He's already on Bactrim. White cell count? Beckett asked.
Dr. Hupp said it was high enough. I don't have the numbers.
Then get him in here. He just volunteered to give blood. Diggins remained standing in position.
Is it true, sir, that we're all carriers of this thing? All the men down here?
Likely, Beckett said. That donor, Diggins.
Sorry, sir, but there are a lot of questions being asked out there. The door's being sealed and all.
We'll just have to sweat it out, Diggins. Are you going to get that blood donor in here? Diggins hesitated, then...
I'll see what I can do, sir.
Diggins turned on one heel and hurried from the room.
Discipline's going to hell,
Foss said. Beckett looked at the monitor. Pulse 83, blood pressure 50/25.
"What's my blood pressure?"
Foss asked. Beckett told her.
"Thought so. I'm experiencing some breathing difficulty. I'm cold. Are my feet trembling?"
Beckett put a hand on her right foot. "No."
"Feels like it. You know, Bill, I've figured out something. I'm not afraid of death. It's dying scares the shit out of me."
She fell silent, then weakly.
"Don't forget, pal. The best damn autopsy."
When she did not continue, Beckett looked up at the monitor. He could feel her pulse slowing under his hand. The monitor read 10 beats per minute and dropping. Blood pressure was diving. Even as he looked, he felt the pulse under his hand stop. The monitor emitted a shrill and continuous electronic shriek. Donzar went around the bed and turned off the monitor. In the sudden silence, Beckett removed his hand from Foss's neck. Tears were running down his cheeks.
"Damn him. Damn him,"
Beckett muttered.
"They are arranging for us to do the autopsies in the OR," Danzan said.
"Oh, fuck off, you bloody French prig," Beckett shouted.
"I have always felt a certain horror of political economists, since I heard one of them say that he feared the famine of 1848 in Ireland would not kill more than 1 million people, and that would scarcely be enough to do much good."
Benjamin Jowett, Master of Balliol, Oxford.
"Surely, Mr. President," the Secretary General said, "some way could be found to save what's left of your DIC team. They seem to be so remarkably well met."
The Secretary General, Hulls Anders Bergen, was a Norwegian educated in England. He had played a number of golf games with the man on the telephone, and on those occasions they had been Hab and Adam. But Adam Prescott was firmly seated in his office as President of the United States today. There was no camaraderie in his voice.
"What is troubling him besides the obvious?" Bergen wondered. It was something that Prescott did not want to say without elaborate preliminaries. The President appeared almost to be rambling.
"Why should he be talking about the procedures for sterilizing infected areas, and in the same breath as the tragedy at Denver? Those procedures had been worked out and accepted by all parties. Could it be something new in the costs?"
"I agree, sir, that the economic realities are a prime consideration," Bergen said.
He listened then while Prescott played out this gambit. The costs, although now thousands of times greater than for any other disaster in human history, were clearly only a part of the President's immediate concern.
"Could he be thinking of sterilizing the Denver complex?" Bergen wondered. The thought set his hand trembling with the telephone against his ear. Bergen, a man who could talk bluntly when it was required of him, asked the question straight out.
"The facilities. Not the people," Prescott said. Bergen heaved a sigh of relief. There was too much death already. This meant, however, that the rumored Colorado plague reservation was a reality. Infected men were to be isolated there. Why couldn't the DIC team be sent there, then?
Could the team work effectively without the DIC facilities? Bergen asked.
Prescott did not think so. Bergen weighed this factor in his mind. Obviously, Prescott and his advisors needed the Denver military facilities. The DIC complex there could be sterilized and made useful once more for the military. But what of the team?
"They saved us days in identifying how the plague was spread," Bergen said. "And now that we've confirmed it was O'Neill, surely the four men..."
The President interrupted. He did not want to isolate such brilliant minds.
"But what was to be done with them when the DIC was put to the fire? There was no comparable facility available in the Colorado Reservation. On a sudden hunch, Bergen asked, "Could they be sent to that new facility in England?" The president was full of immediate and fulsome praise for this brilliant suggestion. Only a genius could have thought of it. Bergen took the red phone away from his ear and stared at it, then brought the instrument back to his ear. Praise was still pouring from it. He stared across the office at the paneled wall, the dark wood door. His desk chair was the best the Danes could supply, and he leaned back in it, the phone still at his ear. A child could have made the suggestion to send those men to England, but Bergen was beginning to see the president's political problem. If the four infected men of the team from the DIC were on an airplane, they might crash in an uninfected region. The crash site would require the panic fire. Bergen raised this question with Prescott, listening for subtle hints in the president's response. Yes, it was too bad the press and public would not accept the official label, New Fire. The words panic and fire had particularly noxious connotations when used together that way. More was beginning to emerge, however. Even if a sealed aircraft did not crash, any new plague outbreak beneath the flight path could arouse powerful suspicions that the occupants had spread the infection, that it had somehow escaped and fallen upon more innocent victims. Demagogues were having a field day, and it would not do to provide them and the nut fringe of fanatics with more ammunition. "I think the French might be willing to supply an escort of fighter planes," Bergen said. He looked at the door to the outer office while Prescott showered him with more praise. The French ambassador was among a group patiently waiting to have lunch with him. A word or two in quiet, perhaps.
"Mr. President, you are more than generous," Bergen said, cutting off the new flow of praise. "Can you get volunteers for their flight crew?"
Again the Secretary General listened. How fortunate that Dr. Beckett of the team was a pilot, Air Force Reserve of all things. And Prescott had this knowledge at his fingertips. How well informed he was. And a long-range aircraft could be made ready. The four men would drive themselves to the airport. They would take off, pick up their escort, and their car and its surroundings would receive its bath of panic fire. Oh, there was one more thing. Could the Secretary General arrange for the four men to receive positions of useful importance at the facility in England? Useful importance, Bergen mused. He decided on a small fishing expedition. Is it the wisest choice to send them to England? That lab at Killaloe in Ireland sounds impressive, especially with all of the new equipment you're providing. But you yourself suggested England, Prescott said. I naturally assumed, since it was your first suggestion, that the British facility was the superior one. England it is, Bergen agreed. It was all very clear now. If anything went wrong, then it was the idea of the Secretary General of the United Nations. It was Bergen, after all, who made the essential arrangements and pushed this project through. The red phone at Bergen's ear had still more tidbits to reveal, however. Prescott had things to say about O'Neill. Bergen looked at his wristwatch while he listened. The hunger pangs were intense. Abruptly, he lifted his chin, startled.
"They think O'Neill's in England?" the Secretary General asked. "Why do they think that?"
As Prescott explained, it made a terrible logic. The victims, if they exposed him, might be afraid to retaliate lest the madman loose an even more terrible disaster upon them. O'Neill had threatened this in one of his letters, after all, and without more certain knowledge, no one could afford the assumption that he was bluffing.
"Why not Ireland?" Bergen asked.
Yes. O'Neill's features were known to some people in Ireland, and even if he disguised himself, well, the psychological people thought the Irish more prone to heedless revenge. Surely O'Neill would have considered this.
It was logical that he would want to hide in an English-speaking country where he was little known and where he could blend into the background more easily. And there was England, a certain amount of chaos and disruption. And England was one of his target areas, a place where he had expressly forbidden those outside to employ atomic sterilization. It made terrifying sense, but even more, if accurate, it exposed the workings of a mind that could cut through a problem like the slash of a sword. Bergen had a certain awareness of this quality in himself. Complexities must be reduced to manageable shape and size, even if this involved pulling from a complexity only that which could be managed. Mad O'Neill might be, but also a genius, a true genius. How much certainty do they attach to this idea? Bergen asked. Ah, yes, the profile. This was more of the DIC team's doing. Prescott and others believed the team was getting into the madman's mind, learning to think the way he does. Bergen silently agreed. Perhaps they were doing this. Certainly, someone must do it. I will make the preliminary arrangements for the flight to England, Bergen said. Someone from my office will call on your people to work out the details. Having achieved his object without ever openly expressing it, the president was willing to let the secretary general go to lunch. There was even a suggestion that they get together soon for a round of golf, and then, finally, a more somber note. Terrible times, yes, Bergen agreed. These are indeed terrible times, sir.